Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here. We have a carryover from yesterday on two of the bills dealing with recordation of grand juries, Senate Bill 496, as well as Senate Bill 505. We have a couple of individuals that are here to give testimony or who will be here to give testimony that aren't quite here. So what I'm going to do, I have two other members here that need to be moving forward in their agenda or their calendar for today. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 257. And Whitney, if you can give us the overview.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 257 was brought to us by Senator Gelser. Senate Bill 257 expands the crime of official misconduct in the first degree to include acts that constitute official misconduct in the second degree when that violation places another person in danger of physical injury or damages property of another person. There is a dash one amendment that would make this offense only applicable when the violation places recklessly places another person in danger of physical injury. So essentially it adds a reckless mental state and eliminates the reference for damaging property.
All right, thank you. Sarah?
Great. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Gelser.
Oh, I like Sarah better. I'm a Quaker. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for having me here this morning. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator for Senate District 8, and also for the record, all of my bills have been referred to your committee. So it's because I miss being on the committee.
Most all.
Most.
We tried to get them all, but we didn't.
Yeah, some of them came to my own committee. I don't like having bills in my own committee. I much prefer you. That was not pandering. So Senate Bill 257 comes out of a series of discussions, to be completely transparent, that began with an issue that you are all aware of that happened at the Department of Human Services. It lasted over a couple of years, where we had a situation where a public official knowingly was placing children in an unlicensed facility, knowing that there was a lack of fitness of the individuals that were working in the facility or group of facilities. And as a result, many of these children suffered serious harm, ranging from sexual abuse to lack of nutrition, to lack of food, to needing to shoplift for basic necessities, which caused them to have criminal records and enter our justice system. As we started to untangle that process in conversations with the Department of Justice, it was challenging and disappointing to realize that the statute at that time would not pick that up, because the official misconduct statute, because that it did not accrue a specific benefit to the public official that had made these decisions. So we changed that law in the last session. Since that time, really trying to understand the way that our official misconduct statute works, even given that high level of harm, there is a very minimal penalty for official misconduct. So this bill is intended to pick up official misconduct and actions that cause injury or recklessly place someone in danger. The Dash 1 amendment is intended to narrow it. The property definition was too broad. We wanted to add that recklessness piece. The idea isn't to pick up people that have made mistakes in good faith. This is where a reasonable person should know that taking this action or inaction would put an individual at risk. The one recommendation I would have to the Dash 1 amendment would be to expand that and point to that right now it reads as the public servant violates ORS 162.405 and by committing the violation recklessly places another person in danger of physical injury. And I would add to that, or abuse is defined under 419B and the child care and agency abuse statute. The reason for that is that, as we've discussed at length in this committee, the definition of physical injury is challenging when it comes to child abuse. And again, we're not talking about a criminal penalty for abuse. We're talking about that danger when the state is responsible for individuals. However, if the committee did not want to go there, I'm also happy with the Dash 1 amendment, but I do believe that pointing to the child abuse statute would help us pick up issues related to lack of nutrition, sexual assault, and some of the other issues that occurred in this particular case. Hopefully, it never needs to be used in the future. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. I'm not sure what your schedule is. If you want questions now, or do you want Aaron to testify first?
We'll let Aaron go first.
Okay, Aaron, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, here in support of and as the lifeline on Senate Bill 257. So just to talk briefly about sort of the structure of how official misconduct works under existing law. There are 2 degrees of official misconduct now, second degree and first degree. The first degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor, applies only when a person disregards an obligation they have as a function of their office, and these are generally public officials, or public servants, I think is the statutory term, if they either intend to harm another person by doing so or they intend to obtain a benefit. You're disregarding a statutory obligation, hoped of receiving something to which you wouldn't normally be entitled, or you're doing it with the intent of harming somebody else. Everything else, the sort of catch-all, is when you violate any statute that relates to the office of a person. That is a Class C misdemeanor. What gave rise to this bill was the discussion that the senator just referenced about if you are tasked with the care of somebody else and you're disregarding your statutory obligations to assure that care, what happens? Under existing law, that would be only a Class C misdemeanor. And we looked at the sort of remainder of all criminal laws to figure out if there would be something else that would apply, a criminal mistreatment or a reckless endangerment. And with both of those, what we concluded is that, typically speaking, a public servant who disregards a statutory obligation may not be the actual actor, you know, the person that is causing the dangerous condition themselves. Instead, they're sort of demonstrating an awareness and an indifference to that condition. That made it not proximate enough for a reckless endangerment or a criminal mistreatment. So what this would propose doing, especially with the Dash 1 amendments, is sweeping in those instances where your conduct places another person in danger of physical injury. The Dash 1 amendments really do 2 things. First, it takes out the property component that the senator referenced, and property that created a lot of challenges. I mean, we didn't want to sweep in sort of low-level unintentional conduct. For example, you have an obligation to lock up the office at night. That's an administrative rule. You forget to do so once. You probably disregarded your obligation. Maybe somebody came in and stole something. That's not exactly what we're trying to get at here. We're trying to get at more deliberate conduct that actually causes the risk of physical injury. So secondly, we added a mental state, reckless, which is going to require something more like a gross disregard of that responsibility, or at least of the possibility that physical injury would result. So in my view, it's a fairly narrowly written bill. I think it'll be applied only in a blue moon, but there is a fact pattern here that I don't believe is adequately covered by existing criminal law. The senator's reference to adding child abuse in here, the Department of Justice doesn't see any real technical challenges with that.
All right. Questions? Senator Brough. Yeah,
thanks, Chair. Just to clarify, Aaron, so or Senator Gelser, the case that you talked about, you know, that triggered this, so under existing statute, we could not have brought charges against this person? Is that true?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Dembrough, I think from my perspective that swerves too close to an advisory opinion on existing possible litigation, so I think I'm going to have to decline to answer how that would be applied to those facts legally.
Okay. But Senator Gelser, that's your understanding.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Dembrough, after a lot of discussions with a lot of people, that was my understanding.
Thank you.
Senator Lethincombe.
Can you describe a little bit how you would weigh or factor the placing an individual in danger of harm? I'm not sure what would constitute a measurable item there. I understand the addition of recklessly gives a little higher standard or bar. How do you cash out the rest of it?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Lethincombe, I can describe to you the fact pattern that made me interested in pursuing this. So if you had a situation where you were public, and so I'm going to use this in the vein of child abuse. You could also probably, if we did that amendment, we'd want to include elder abuse and vulnerable adult abuse as well. The public official is aware that there are dangerous conditions that violate the law in a facility and orders children to be placed there in violation of the law. Subsequently, the children end up incarcerated for activities that they engage in for survival. They are not taken for medical examinations after sexual assault. Their children continue to be placed in a facility after staff are knowingly prosecuted and convicted of having sex with children, and people are still put in that place. That is that type of pattern where it's very clear that you have a dangerous circumstance, but for whatever other reason, you are ordering your subordinate staff to continue placing children or vulnerable adults or elderly people into a situation that is known to be dangerous and a violation of the law.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies it. I was curious if it was specifically to criminal misconduct, and it appears so.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, not necessarily. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily arise when somebody had a criminal charge. A person could be harmed or placed at risk of harm, and there might not be a criminal charge against someone else. Lifeline?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, Senator Gelser. I would agree with the senator that what it's going to turn on isn't the presence or absence of another criminal charge. It's going to turn on the presence or absence of the danger of physical injury. So I wouldn't want you to presuppose that if you have somebody who's placed into a dangerous situation. Okay, let me back up for a second. So if you're a public official and you intend to place somebody in harm's way, that would be intentional. If you know that if you put somebody in a situation for which you are responsible, harm would result, it would be knowing. Reckless is sort of what the senator described. You're aware of hazardous conditions. You know, you're aware that the building isn't safe, nutrition isn't adequate, there are risk of sexual abuse, and that can be demonstrated that you had that awareness and you sort of recklessly disregarded the possibility that a physical injury would result. That can attach whether or not anybody is actually ultimately charged for criminal neglect, reckless endangerment, anything like that. So while it certainly uses criminal terminology and is rooted in criminal law, I don't think there would always be criminal charges.
Okay. I think where my mind is struggling is, on one hand, we're describing this official misconduct concept where we understand and know the rules and we either intentionally or purposely or negligently don't comply with those rules. And then there's this hinge point out there that I don't see cashing out very clearly, which is the hinge point for placing somebody in danger. The text in the dash one specifically says places another person in danger of physical injury, and I'm not sure how that marries with the others. That's all I'm trying to get a handle on.
Okay, well, we'll go over that.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Linthicum, I think one piece, and I can get this for you later, part of what we did a year ago in 2015 was to get to that point of official misconduct where you are failing to take an action that is required. We put into the statute some very specific requirements around recognizing and evaluating safety or taking action when there is a dangerous place. So I will get that to you, and that might answer that question a little bit better.
We won't be moving the bill today. There's a little bit of work that needs to be done.
Okay.
And I'm going to have a conversation with Senator Gelser on her proposed amendment on the dash ones, and I'll put something on the record in a minute. Senator Manning, and then Senator Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. You had alluded to that in regards to elders. Or elder abuse, is that also included in this bill? Because I think that's really important. You know, sometimes, you know, we look at think that these things only apply to children. Well, in fact, they're happening every day to elders as well. You know, people that are in retirement communities and, you know, or assisted living communities that are being neglected, willfully neglected, because of maybe the rent increase went up and now they're being tossed out on the street because they can't come up with $100 more dollars in order to live there. So would this also, is this also going to be included, or is it already included in there?
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Manning, that is really that out loud thinking around enhancement to that dash one amendment. I think it would, it basically would need to be abused. If you're, there are other agencies to which this could apply. Certainly this came out of an understanding of issues at the Department of Human Services, where when the department has the responsibility for the safety of an elderly person, a person with an intellectual or developmental disability, a mental illness, a physical injury, or a child in state custody, that is a pretty high level of responsibility. And my intention in working with the chair and others and the Department of Justice would be to have something that is narrowly tailored, that does not pick up accidents or unintentional pieces, but goes to the idea of ignoring, because it is convenient, serious safety issues and continuing to put the people that we are responsible for in harm's way.
Thank you. All right, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. If there's one thing I've learned is that you can make a law for an agency or the government and it doesn't mean they need to obey it. I mean, it's just simple as that. And often there's no teeth to it. But what I'm thinking about here is actually when I first read the bill, the first thing that popped into my head is the lead that was in the water in different locations. And also, OSP, they're tasked with keeping our highways safe, but if legislators don't give them enough money, are we putting people in physical danger by not doing so? I just wonder how deep or something like this could go. Same with CASAs for foster kids. And we know that foster kids who have a CASA are much better off. And those that don't fare as well.
So, Chair Pruszynski, Senator Thatcher, I think that is a really good question. The intention would be to point to that statutory obligation. It's the failure to take an action that you're required to take under statute. So I don't know that the legislature is required by statute to adequately fund anything. Otherwise, the world might be a very different place. But I would trust the chair and others to help us work through that piece. That certainly would not be the goal. In terms of a CASA or a really great example, a caseworker. This is, if we're talking about human services, whether that's elder abuse or child abuse, that is really hard work. You have to make a lot of difficult judgments. Sometimes the judgment is going to be wrong. What this is getting at is that willful knowing that there is a problem, disregarding that and moving forward and putting vulnerable people at risk, which was the fact pattern in this particular case where we have the public records that demonstrate the public official was told that these things occurred, that children had been hurt, that children would be hurt, and then subordinates were still ordered to continue to place people in these circumstances. That is the fact pattern that we're trying to get at.
Thank you. I understand that, but I know that CASAs are required, but they're not being done. For instance, that's just an example, and I'm just wondering if that agency would suddenly be held, to this standard, or if it would apply maybe more widely, but I understand the intention, and I understand that thoroughly, and I get that, and I think it's a good thing, but I just want to make sure we're not accidentally sweeping up
fair point
these people.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbrough.
Yeah, no, just I think the senator raises a very good point, and obviously in the enforcement of this, we would want to really, maintain a high burden of proof, right, that this was willful and the person knew that this was wrong and perhaps had even been consulting with others and still chose to go ahead. We certainly wouldn't want to see this abused in any way because employees are often, or volunteers in some cases, are in very difficult circumstances given the limited means we give them.
All right, any other comments or thoughts? Let me just put a couple of things on the record. Based on what Senator Gelser had suggested as an amendment or an addition to the dash ones, I will just say that looking at the definition of abuse under 419B.005, I have concerns with sub 1A, sub A, large B, which gets into the mental injury of a child. I think we're getting into a situation where we're diverting from physical injury, and now we're going to get into an area that I think can be an extremely hard proof issue to go forward. So we'll talk about that. We also will be talking about the term recklessly places, as to if that's going to be the mental element, because what I've just heard everyone talk about here is willful, wanton, knowing, knowledge, and I think we need to make certain that we're not having a lesser standard, if that's what we're talking about, as compared to being reckless. So with that, we're going to do some additional work before we bring it back. I expect that we'll have something move forward, but we want to make sure we cross our T's and dot our I's.
Chair, could you repeat the reference you just had?
Yeah, ORS 419B.005, and then within the definitions, it's abuse, and it's B under the abuse talks about any mental injury to a child and then goes on beyond that.
Okay, thank you.
There's a lot more that's captured in the term abuse. That was just one I just saw real quick and just wanted to kind of let people know where we're at and why we're going to take a little bit more time. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and let me just ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 257. Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. And Senator Frederick, I'm going to go ahead and open up the bill that you're here on to take your testimony. I am going to get a read from others that are here to make additional or give their testimony on 496 and 505. But once you go ahead and sit down, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 360. And Whitney, if you can give us the overview.
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 360 was brought to us by Senator Frederick. Senate Bill 360 directs the Department of Corrections to create a community service exchange program. This program would allow persons on parole or post-prison supervision to perform community service in lieu of payment for certain specified delinquent fees or debts and supervision and attorney fees. Senate Bill 360 specifies the procedures for this program and also defines key terms. There's also a dash one amendment that makes some minor technical changes. There is also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do have the revenue on the dash one, but we are still waiting on the fiscal, although I can double check that.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and take Senator Frederick, your testimony at this point.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, Senate District 22, that's North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to tell you about Senate Bill 360 that I introduced after hearing the stories of previously incarcerated individuals who are making an honest effort to get not only to get back on their feet, but also to reenter society as contributing members. It's probably not news to you that this is a daunting project, but one that we all have a stake in. Successful reentry to law-abiding life represents success for the individual and his or her family, for the community, and for our system for dealing with unlawful behavior. A popular perception of prison time is that it represents paying one's debt to society. However, there are a number of other debts that a person convicted of a crime might incur. These include, for example, restitution to victims harmed by a crime. This bill is not about that. Part of successful reentry is acceptance of responsibility for harm done and an honest effort to make those whole who have been harmed. This bill is also not about fines imposed as part of that of sentencing. Many of our criminal statutes call for both prison time and fines as penalties payable to the state for crimes committed. Successful payment of these penalties is also part of an honest effort to get back on track. A person may also have debts that pile up due to inability to pay during incarceration, such as child support. This bill is not about that. My conversations with individuals struggling with reentry indicate that they understand their direct responsibilities to crime victims, to the state, to custodial parents, and are working to make those things right. But there is one class of debt that surprises many of them: court and supervision fees. Fees may be imposed for court costs, for court-appointed representation, for some costs related to incarceration, for post-release supervision, and there may be other categories. These debts are in suspense during incarceration, but become due and begin accruing interest upon release. The collections clock begins ticking the day they are released. Now, I'm not talking often about white-collar criminals here. I'm talking about an individual who comes out without assets, without a job, often without a home. Within 30 days, he or she needs to either pay these debts in their entirety or commit to a payment plan. If they are able to get employment, they may face wage garnishment. They may be referred to private collection firms and may report contacts at all hours, which may or not be a legal or ethical practice, but what are they going to do about it? As the hole gets deeper, the hope required to find and deal with the parts that they can deal with slips away. The hope of making it out of that hole may die. Prison may not seem that bad after these kinds of things. So this bill is an attempt to make the light visible at the end of the tunnel. The goal is to create a way for individuals committed to successful reentry to pay their part of their debt in the currency they have, community service. This service would be supervised and meaningful. It would also be contingent on continuing to stay out of trouble. Under this bill, the debt would be reinstated upon additional conviction within 5 years, even if the service obligation had been completed. You mentioned the amendments that are already, there are some other amendments that may be coming that way to have agencies imposing their fees be able to vet the quality of those community service groups. That's one of the issues that we've had with several of the folks there. It also should be noted that some counties already do some of this plan, and there's a long list, for instance, in Washington County of community service options that they use, but not other counties do not have that, and they may need help finding nonprofits to develop this kind of a system. But I think it would be helpful, and I think it begins to, as I said early on, really clear up what we really mean by paying one's debt to society. We shouldn't be paying one's debt to society forever. And unfortunately, in some of these court fees, that is what it takes. We are also not talking about $100 and $200. Sometimes we're talking $12,000. And I have three people who are going to be speaking to this a little later on that you may want to listen to them as well with their own personal experiences regarding that.
Yeah. All right. Any questions for Senator Frederick? Senator Manning?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Fredericks, I remember providing testimony, I think last year when you first brought this bill forward, and I was in support of it. For the record, I am still in support of it because of my experience working in the criminal justice system. You know, it seems like, you know, violators that have paid their debt to society sometimes continue for the rest of their lives pay their debt to society, and you wonder, is there ever an end? And when we have people that are coming out trying to reintegrate back into society, which we talk about rehabilitation, it makes it very difficult for them to get a home, to get a job. So this is a great effort. There are a lot of nonprofits that will provide the types of resources, and not only that, the experiences that they're going to need in order to transition back into community by providing job opportunities and options of upward mobility. I think it's all relevant to this, and I thank you for bringing this bill forward, because this is something that if we are truly committed to rehabilitation and giving people a fair chance, this is it's not a large step, but it is a great first effort to move forward. So thank you again for that.
Thank you.
Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you for bringing the bill again. You know, I remember a few years ago being at work at Portland Community College's Cascade campus, and I think it was the weekend, and there was at that time a program called Project Clean Slate, and I remember the campus being filled with people who were trying to find out about that program and participate in that program, and it was a very happy day, I have to say, and it was infectious, just seeing the sort of renewed hope in people's eyes, you know, that had, you know, obviously they were up against very serious obstacles, and suddenly they saw a path to get out of that, to get that burden off of them. If what you're proposing here is something similar to that, then I think that you're proposing a very good program indeed.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Thank you, Senator Denbrough. This is an addition to that, or the addition to the idea. I was at that same day. I just thought I'd stop by and see how it was going to happen. They expected 300 folks to show up. They had 3,000. It was really an extraordinary event, and it continued for quite a while. This is an attempt to deal with some of those same issues in a different way. I don't think people understood the kind of court fee issue that I'm talking about at that time. Now they do, and I think there are people more than willing to step forward and say, okay, let's see, how do we handle this? Different agencies impose different fees, so it's not just one agency, but this allows some options.
All right, thank you. Lou, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
So before we continue, what I'm going to do is I did make a commitment to those who were here yesterday to give testimony on the recordation bill, Senate Bill 496 and 505. I believe everyone's here. I'm wondering if anyone has a pressing schedule or if you can stand by for another maybe 10 minutes, and then we could take all of the testimony that's carried over, plus one other person, I believe, that signed up. If there's not anyone raising their hands on those that were witnesses here yesterday, I'm going to go ahead and continue the testimony on Senate Bill 360, so everything will be together. And so is it Mr. Ramirez?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Olson? Why don't you two come forward? While they're coming forward, I know we have Mary Sell, and it looks like Jessica Campy also.
Campy.
Campy, that's right.
Yes.
Will be testifying. Is there anyone else who wants to be testifying on Senate Bill 360?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay. So whoever would like to get started?
Okay. Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Harry Olson. I am the founder of Phoenix Rising Transition and a leader in the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, the MACG, in Portland. I am also a certified recovery peer mentor. I am here to urge you to support Senate Bill 360. This bill will ease the financial burdens of those coming out of prison and support their aim to make it in the community as successful, law-abiding citizens. I lead the mentor project at Phoenix Rising Transitions. I have been working with people coming home from prison for over 25 years. Before that, I was in and out of prison for 15 years. The last time I came home in 1991, I lived with my mom and two small boys, 8 and 10. She gave me room, board, a bus pass, and $5 a week until I got a job. In those days, that was enough. There were no parole fees, but over the years, I have watched as court costs, supervision fees, class costs, and the interest accrued while incarcerated have swelled. These are often so steep that a person's dreams of carving out a new life in the community seem impossible. And unfortunately, some give up and return to crime and prison. Others are able to persevere, but are in a constant state of anxiety about how to meet all their financial needs. The mentees I work with in Phoenix want to leave crime behind. Excuse me, to leave crime behind. They are highly motivated, and most have done well at getting jobs. They are committed to paying what they owe, especially child support and restitution to victims. But people who have been in prison typically make 40% less than their peers. We'd like to share two stories of mentees who couldn't be here because they're at work. So this is Frank's story. I have been out for a couple of years now and have been working since the day I came home. It's a good job, but I hardly make my bills. I'm being garnished for a past fine of over $5,000. My current address is on file at DMV, but somehow no one researched that fact. Instead, they sent notification to an address over 10 years old, and then all of a sudden I'm being garnished for 25% of my wages. That's about $600 per month on top of the $363 in back child support. Now that I'm already in garnishment, I'm told there is no recourse. I don't mind paying my debts, but how about a little less trauma to my finances here? This bill would help me just to make it in a somewhat comfortable fashion, I would at least make a life, it would at least make a life of crime seem a little less appealing. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ezekiel Ramirez Jr. I'd like to share the experience of my housemate, Gary. This is Gary's story. I was released from prison on March 1st, 2013. Reentering society is a challenge. One of my first welcome home messages was that I would have to pay $7,960 before I could get my driver's license back, because somehow the county courts were unable to locate me when I was sent to prison. My $775 fine was sent to collections for 5 years. I had to work without being able to drive. For well over a year, I paid that off, all the while having to pay monthly supervision fees for the privilege of being on post-prison supervision, which at times prevented me from working on the north side of the Columbia River. Last year, I was released from post-prison supervision. I paid a total of $1,260 in supervision fees alone. I have also paid nearly $1,100 to Marion County and well over $10,000 to Lane County in the calendar year 2016. I paid $1,327 to wrap up the last known fines owed to county courts. Any options for working off monies that may be available to people coming home from prison are a good idea. Often prisoners are unable to pay the steep fines and fees required of them by courts and supervisory agencies. I know of far too many people who, in hopeless despair, turn again to crime and drugs and were again incarcerated at the expense of taxpayers. I am just one voice, but I implore decision makers to support Senate Bill 360 and approve alternatives to monetary payments of fines and fees. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward and sharing the stories.
Thank you.
We appreciate
thank you.
It. All right, Mary Sell and Jessica Campy. Ms. Campy, I'm sorry. When I was looking at it, I looked like an O. I said, it's not an E. I didn't think A.
That would be my fault. That's my handwriting. I do apologize. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sell. I am a co-lobbyist with Gail Meyer with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm here this morning in support of Senate Bill 360. OCDLA does want to extend a thank you to Senator Frederick for putting forth this bill. We do want to thank the committee for considering voting yes on this. You've already heard from two of the most important people in the room, three if you count Senator Frederick. The stories that these gentlemen shared with you are really what you need to hear. What we can add is simply our support. Over the last 5 years that I've been practicing as an attorney, I have had the fortunate opportunity to represent many clients. Some of those clients did end up going to the Department of Corrections. And while my career has been relatively short in comparison to some people in this room, that was plenty of time for me to have clients go into the Department of Corrections and then also come out. I fielded many phone calls from my clients after coming back out into the community, and they would be asking for my help, asking for resources, asking for direction on how can they get back on their feet. There are many community-based programs that can help, but a bill like Senate Bill 360 would really add something for these people who do struggle. And as you heard from the gentleman who testified prior, sometimes they can barely make ends meet. And I think we all know, living in 2017 in Portland or in Oregon in general, that it can be really difficult to meet obligations anyway, given the way that the economy is going and the high price of rent and things like that. And so when people are coming out into the community without as much family support as some people, possibly without any type of savings, being able to use a program like this would be amazing. And so I'm going to keep my comments brief. I'm going to close. I'm going to thank you. And I would like to introduce you to Jessica Campy. She is the executive director of the Marion County Public Defender's Office. And I'll cede the floor to her.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for hearing from me today. I am the director of the Public Defender's Office here locally. I'm also a volunteer at Shelley's House, which is a reentry home for women coming out of the Department of Corrections. It's a clean and sober house for women reentering our community. I've seen many people struggle.
And Jessica, I need you to put your full name on the record, please.
Thank you. Excuse me, Chair Przanski. My full name is Jessica Campy, and thank you. I've seen many people coming out of prison that are struggling with these fees and fines. The fines, there's a $100 conviction fee for every misdemeanor. There's a $200 conviction fee for every felony. There are court-appointed attorney fees. There are supervision fees that accrue at $30 to $40 a month. And people come out and try to reenter the community, and they are just saddled with all of this debt. And frequently, the debt ends up going into collections because they're not making their payments on it. And once the debt goes into collections, it ruins their credit history, which makes it harder for them to find housing or apply for a loan. It also prevents them from getting their driver's licenses reinstated. And so we see that driver's licenses get suspended for a large range of crimes. It's a very common sanction that occurs on many different crimes. And then when people come out and they're saddled with this debt, they're not able to get that driver's license back until they've paid all of their debt back first. It's very difficult to get a job in many areas of Oregon if you don't have a driver's license. In Marion County, there's very limited public transportation that's available to people. So we see this cycle happening where people aren't able to get the employment that they need to pay down the debt because they can't get the license they need to get to the job. And it just builds on itself. Additionally, then we see people that make a difficult decision to drive without the license, and they end up back in the system with new charges as a result of that decision. And so I'm very much in favor of a bill that allows people another option on how they may be able to pay down those debts through a currency that they have, which is their time and their ability to perform service to the community. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Yeah, I was pretty blown away when they said I had to pay back $8,000 before we get a license back. It's like, how do you get your license? You know, it's like a vicious circle. But it also struck me that the county didn't know they were in. Why is there no communication with people who are incarcerated to, you know, help them be able to let people know out there that this is where I am? And I don't know. It just seems like there should be some way to communicate that instead of just being dropped as if that person fell off the edge of the earth, because they haven't. They're just incarcerated. Can't do much about it. But I'm wondering if it happens very often where, in your experience, if people are just not counting child support, because that's a federal law where your license is taken away if you're, you know, at a certain point in your child support, but for just fees, not being able to pay the fees and getting a license suspended, does that happen a lot in your experience?
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, your comments are well taken, and it's a great question. Anecdotally, from my experience, yes, many of my clients have gone without licenses simply because they cannot pay court fines and fees. And so I believe that that's absolutely a problem. And I think that this is going to be a conversation that we probably have the entire session, but that's just an example of a collateral consequence. And it's not a small collateral consequence.
Senator Dimbro.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This committee is going to be here over the next few weeks. We're going to be hearing several bills, actually, that came out of the reentry task force that the legislature created back in 2015. And Senator Frederick was part of that task force as well. This bill preexisted the task force. He had developed it last time. But the problems, the obstacles that people who are formerly incarcerated face when they come out are multiple and complex. And you'll be hearing some recommendations related to, so this is dealing with the problem of people facing these issues upon, you know, release and then reentry. We'll be talking next week about a bill that is looking at pre-entry, that is making sure that before they go into incarceration, they've got their affairs in order, and to help make that happen. And so I think you'll be really interested to hear that bill. We also have one that is dealing directly with the suspended driver's license issue. There are a number of states that are taking action on that, and we'll be hopefully following them. And you'll see several bills related to these obstacles in various forms, seeing what we can do as a state to relieve some of those burdens. And, you know, we know that that helps with successful reentry and reducing recidivism.
All right. Any other questions, comments, Senator Thatcher?
Yeah, I had a quick question about attorney fees. I noticed that that would be one of the things that could be worked out through community service. And I guess I'm imagining private practice attorney fees, but probably public defenders. Is that or both?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, it would be court-appointed attorney's fees. Yes, and because that would be imposed at the time of the sentence, or those, rather, those would be imposed.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ask one last time. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 360? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing on 360. As we heard, there's additional work that needs to be done on that one, so we'll try to get through that and get it scheduled for a work session in the future. I think at this point what I'm going to do is go ahead and reconvene for the testimony that we were not able to complete yesterday. And so I'm going to go ahead at this point and reopen the public hearings on Senate Bill 496 as well as Senate Bill 505. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead, based on the way I charted this out for yesterday, Steve Dole, Aaron Olson, and Michael Savaggio, you three will please come up. Whoever wants to start.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher. My name is Aaron Olson. I am an attorney in private practice. My practice consists primarily of representing crime victims in civil and criminal cases. Most of my clients are vulnerable victims. They are children or the elderly. Before I went into private practice 13 years ago, I was a prosecutor in three different jurisdictions. Two of those jurisdictions recorded grand juries. Those were the federal government and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. One of them did not, and that's Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. As a result of those experiences, I come to you today with no opposition to the idea of recording grand juries. I don't think it's a bad thing. With that said, in this state, 10 years ago, the citizens voted to amend our Constitution to afford rights to crime victims in criminal cases. And I'm going to address my comments to Senate Bill 496 because I haven't heard that anybody really wants the prosecutors pushing the record button. The Crime Victims Bill of Rights, Article 1, Section 42 and 43, include the purposes of according crime victims due dignity and respect, and also ensuring that a fair balance is struck between the rights of crime victims and the rights of criminal defendants. And I don't think Senate Bill 496 goes far enough to accord these rights to crime victims. A crime victim cannot him or herself seek a protective order for testimony or records that were presented to the grand jury. They can ask the prosecutor nicely if they will move for a protective order, but crime victims themselves do not have that ability. Victims often have no idea that their health or school records have been subpoenaed to the grand jury. Unlike other jurisdictions, there is no obligation to inform someone that their records have been subpoenaed in Oregon criminal cases. much of the information in these records has no bearing on the investigation that the grand jury has conducted, and yet crime victims have no ability to seek protection of these records other than to ask the prosecutor to please do so. Additionally, if a crime victim feels that their testimony before the grand jury went far or was or got into privileged communications or confidential information, they just don't have the ability to seek recourse from a court to protect that information. As you know, nobody has the right to have an attorney with them before the grand jury. So a crime victim who answers questions in good faith and but later comes to understand that that questioning was improper has no recourse. I think that this is one example of the imbalance that this bill creates. Another is the ability of the defendant to use grand jury testimony to impeach victims in later proceedings, but the inability of prosecutors to use grand jury testimony to allow those same victims and witnesses to refresh their recollection. And I understand that there is a provision that allows the introduction of grand jury testimony when it has been used to impeach, been used to refresh a recollection, but that would only apply to the persons who have access to that testimony. And the access provisions are limited to prosecutors, defense attorneys, and agents of the prosecution, agents of defense attorneys. It doesn't apply to victims and witnesses. So it seems to me, if testimony can be used to impeach a victim, it should also be able to be used to refresh that victim's recollection. You heard Mr. Beglau testify yesterday that you may see an increase in the use of preliminary hearings, which in Oregon I've never experienced, and they are, right, to my knowledge, they aren't used at all anymore. But because preliminary hearings are recorded, those recordings don't have the restrictions that grand jury recordings do, you may see an uptick in the use of preliminary hearings, and I don't think that benefits victims either, the right to cross-examine, particularly for vulnerable victims who are then going to be subjected to cross-examination again at trial, I don't think benefits anyone. And finally, there's no notification when the testimony of a victim or a witness is sought to be made public. The defense attorney and the prosecutor have the right to approach the court in cases that are true billed and ask that testimony be released. But a victim may well not know that his or her testimony is about to become a matter of public record. They're told, in all likelihood, that the testimony before the grand jury is secret. I've heard testimony that the purposes of this bill are accountability and transparency. And accountability seems to be a buzzword for a deterrence of prosecutorial misconduct or the ability to remedy that. I don't think anybody doubts that this bill will accomplish that, that it will make prosecutors more accountable to what happens in front of a grand jury. But I'm not clear on how this bill serves the transparency goals that there's been a lot of talk about. Only when a not true bill is returned in the case of the investigation of a public servant can any person apply to have that testimony made public. In all other cases, in true billed cases, only the prosecutor and the defense can seek to have testimony made public. And in cases in which cases withdrawn from the grand jury, that is, no true bill or not true bill is sought, nobody can have access to that information. And so transparency is very limited. I think if there was true transparency in this bill, it would give anyone the right to ask for the release of grand jury testimony in cases in which there are substantial and compelling reasons or some high level of cause to release the transcripts. And finally, there are a couple of practical issues that have sort of been touched upon. Senator Thatcher yesterday asked the Alaska attorney about the motion practice that might result from this bill. In Massachusetts, the motion practice was, I think as the Alaska attorney said, robust. We called them McCarthy or Odell motions. They were brought to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence presented to the grand jury, or they were brought to challenge potential misconduct before the grand jury, such as that you heard about yesterday from Mr. Schmidt. An Odell motion was and oftentimes because there had been obvious exculpatory evidence that the prosecution knew about, but that evidence was not presented to the grand jury, and it would have created enough doubt to cause a not true bill. I think that those motions are going to be substantial. Many of my cases had those motions and required significant pretrial litigation, and that is a practical aspect that I think has not been considered. The other is that I think it'll be malpractice in most serious cases if no transcript is prepared of the grand jury testimony. And that is another expense that I think this legislative body needs to anticipate. A final minor point. In Section 2, Paragraph 2C, the bill says that the testimony of a grand jury juror who testifies in substance on the issues before the grand jury is not to be recorded, and that to me just doesn't make sense. I think that if we're going to record the substantive testimony of witnesses before the grand jury, that should include all witnesses. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Steve?
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United supports the recording of grand jury only with adequate protection for crime victims and witnesses. Senate Bills 496 and 505 do not provide such protections. Rather, they subject virtually all victims and witnesses to new risks, new barriers to justice, and new opportunities for revictimization. Counter to what you heard from the criminal defense attorneys from Alaska and Idaho yesterday, I don't believe that victims have a fear of recording. They don't fear recording. What they fear is that recording being handed over immediately after the grand jury to the perpetrator. Three critical goals must be achieved by any recordation legislation. One, victims must not be re-victimized or threatened with additional victimization. Police officers must be allowed to testify for all victims and witnesses as is done in virtually every other state that relies on grand jury. You saw the presentation by the District Attorneys Association yesterday, and you could see in that presentation that there are 39 states that record out of all the states that utilize grand juries, and that there's only one of those states that doesn't allow for case agent testimony. This should not be just for juveniles. This should be not just for the developmentally disabled, as is in the bill, but this should be for every victim, for every crime, every time. And I hope that's a familiar saying to many of you up there, because that was the policy of the former Attorney General of the State of Oregon, Hardy Myers. That's how he operated his office when it came to victims. Every victim, every crime, every time. It is unacceptable to require a rape victim, a robbery victim, a child molestation victim, an assault victim, or the victim of a family of a murder victim to have their testimony recorded and then shared with the very person that victimized them. It is unacceptable that a witness cannot be guaranteed that their testimony will not be released to a defendant bent on retribution. How much pain must a victim endure to receive justice? Number two, all personal medical records must be kept from the defendants. Under these bills, records presented to grand juries divulging the most intimate and private details from a crime victim's medical file will presumptively be released to the individual who caused their injuries. Should they seek to have these records withheld, they must either rely on the district attorney to seek a protective order or to hire their own attorney to protect their rights to privacy. How much cost must a victim pay to achieve justice? Number three, the balance between the state, the accused, and the victim must be maintained. It has taken over 40 years to achieve meaningful victims' rights in Oregon. Sometimes through the legislature, and we're grateful for that, but sometimes, many times, we had to go to the initiative system to achieve these rights. These bills threaten to upend this struggle and these achievements. And make no mistake about it, these are not just about legal rights. The right to be heard, the right to be present, the right to speak are basic human rights. Already the defense has an opportunity to cross-examine a witness based on their statements to law enforcement. The more frequently they tell their story, the more frequently they are subjected to attack under the auspices of seeking the truth. Obtaining justice is a grueling and arduous process for victims. They are often on trial as much or more than the criminal defendant. How many more hardships must a victim face to achieve justice? Senate Bills 496 and 505 erode the exceptional gains that have been achieved for victims in this state. They erect new and unnecessary barriers to achieving justice in Oregon's most violent and despicable cases. They are unfair, they are unbalanced, and they are unacceptable. Crime Victims United supports the passage of a grand jury recordation bill that includes full case agent testimony and reasonable protective orders. It is a policy that protects the innocent, protects victims, and protects the balance of our criminal justice system. And I might add that I grew up in North Portland as a kid back in the 50s and 60s. And one of the things I learned there and learned later when I unfortunately became a member of Parents of Murdered Children is that despite our differences and despite the shade of our skin, that we all bleed the same red blood and we all cry the same salty tears. And that, again, all victims, regardless of color, ethnicity, gender, religious affiliation, sexual orientation, should be protected equally. That we should not have discrimination and balkanization in our criminal justice process when it comes to victims, no matter what their age, no matter what their abilities are. I appreciate your time very much, and thank you.
Thank you. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio. I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies in a number of departments. And the testimony that we've heard on this bill over the last day and a half focused almost entirely on the recordation and provision to the defense of grand jury testimony. And we can see that that is a practice that could add to Oregonians' confidence in a fair and accountable criminal justice system. And barring some technical issues to be worked out, I would love to be able to come back to you and say that we support this bill on that basis. But an issue that has really not been aired in front of this committee at all, and in fact was only just alluded to by Ms. Olson, is the provision of, the public release of records in cases where a public servant, or in the Dash 1 amendments, a peace officer has been the target of that grand jury but has returned not a true bill. So we have this element here that goes a little bit beyond the testimony that we heard yesterday, and to my understanding is not an essential element of what we've been discussing over the last 2 days. What we've heard from some of the prior witnesses, recordation is a necessary step. I believe Representative Williamson said that the intent is to record the process as it is. Gail Myers with the defense attorneys brought up the question, who gets access to the records, and that testimony, I believe, was focused on how that testimony gets provided to the defense attorneys and under what circumstances that's protected. At the current moment, with that additional piece in Section 3, Subsection 3, we're unable to support the bill as it is. We feel that providing for a specific release provision only in instances where the person is returned not a true bill, meaning that they're not going to be forwarded to trial, that creates a two-tiered justice system, really, based on a person's profession. And establishing different rules based on a profession, we feel, is a staggeringly dangerous precedent. On an individual level, the release of a private record of a one-sided proceeding in cases where an officer was not found to have broken any laws and not given the privilege of a defense attorney seems to serve no other purpose than to satisfy a morbid curiosity. But if we do intend to have this discussion, and if we do intend to air this policy, I would ask, let's do this in a separate context than this grand jury bill. This is certainly not a simple issue, as we've heard from the district attorneys, as we've heard from this panel, as we've heard from the defense attorneys. This is complex enough, even without this element. I've taken the liberty of requesting amendments to extricate that particular element. It's not our intention to drastically affect the rest of the bill. It's not our intention to affect what district attorneys may currently do under their own power. But it is something that we feel, if we're going to make policy decisions on, we should very clearly have those discussions in the proper context. And this is an element that we feel is extraordinarily significant that doesn't even get a mention in the bill summary. So I would humbly request that if the bill moves forward, we examine extricating that particular element. We feel that it's not essential to the rest of the bill. We would love to conceptually support at this point what the result might be. I'd need to see language before we finalize that, but we'd be happy to work with the committee going forward on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Dimbro first.
Thanks. Mike, I just want to follow up on your testimony. So did I hear you say that the only reason that the public might have an interest in a case where, you know, there was an officer involved issue was morbid curiosity?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the public has a funny way of determining what their own interest is, and I respect that. The point that I'm trying to make here is that in establishing the two-tiered approach, I would feel that if the public felt that they had an interest in knowing the content of a grand jury proceeding, that would be equally applicable to most proceedings. I can't think when that wouldn't, why there would be a separate tier in the -1 amendments for police officers and then not for, for instance, legislators, if you'll excuse me, or prominent members of the community. I understand that there is, it's been brought up that there's some public lack of confidence sometimes in proceedings occasionally. That's not limited to police officers or even to public servants.
Okay, I'll just, if I could just follow up. I mean, just Speaking on behalf of communications I get from constituents, I think there is a lot of concern out there about officer-involved shootings or such things. And I think it is a special case, and I think that there really I think there's benefits to everyone, including the officers, to having this you know, information that, you know, it's cleared them of you know, a decision to indict. That seems that it's in everybody's interest to me.
Is that a question?
I don't know if it was or wasn't. Do you feel like you need to respond?
I mean, I'm just saying that that's something I hear a lot from constituents.
It sounded to me like a statement. All right, Senator Lithicum.
I was just curious. Mr. Dole, Ms. Olson, are your testimonies submitted to OLIS? I don't think I saw them online. Your written document you were reading from, has that been submitted?
I have. Mr. Chair, Senator Lithicum, I have not, but I will.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Chair Pruszynski, Senator Lithicum, no, I didn't prepare written testimony.
Okay.
I can if you'd like.
I would love to see you read from notes. I would love to see that, if you wouldn't mind submitting that.
Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, just from my understanding, that everyone is in favor or would be supportive of grand jury recordings, just that there are some certain cosmetic but very important requirements that should be attached or fixed. For example, making sure that we protect crime victims so that they are not victimized a second time. And I think that was part of the initial conversation on how this thing was supposed to be designed. I think there might be some opportunities to refine some language in there, and I do agree with that. So I think that there is going to be additional work that's going to be done on this, and I would offer, again, and agree with Senator Lithicum, that perhaps that testimony should be made available so for consideration as they go through a refining process to clarify specific areas of concern. Just a comment.
Ms. Olson, I had one question for you. In your presentation, you talk about the motion practice around grand jury proceedings. It's my understanding the way the bills have been drafted, they're narrowly as to what they can be used for, and I thought they were actually called out that they would not be able to challenge the underpinnings of the indictment, that it was exclusively could be used only for impeachment purposes. So I'm wondering, and I understand other states have motion practices, but if these bills do not allow for that, what the context is.
Chair Pruszynski, it's a very good question. There is a provision in Senate Bill 496 and its companion that say that you can only use the recorded testimony for certain purposes. It is a statute, and as you know, the statutes are trumped by constitutional due process protections. Massachusetts has a very similar, if not identical, provision in its statutory body that says you can't challenge the sufficiency of evidence presented to a grand jury. But the cases that I cited, Commonwealth versus McCarthy, Commonwealth versus Odell, those cases say, yes, but due process trumps your statutory protections against use of the grand jury material. There wasn't sufficient evidence, then the constitutional rights of the criminal defendant have been violated.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Steve, you look like you wanted to say something.
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Manning, what I want to make clear from my comments, yes, we do support recordation. This is the third session we've been on this thing, and as I'm sure you're aware, and I guess if I were sitting in your seat, I'd ask, why hasn't this been done by now? And it's not been done for one simple reason, that all we ask is that where we have victims who are afraid of their perpetrators, that we allow for case agent testimony to take place. That, as I said before, of all the states, including the federal government, that allow for recording, they allow for this except for one. You heard from him yesterday, Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Our next panel is Dave Factor, Patrick Singh, and Doug Barber.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Thatcher, committee members. My name is David Factor. I'm staff counsel with the Oregon Judicial Department. Here today to speak to Senate Bills 496 and 505 on behalf of the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice has been consistent over the in regards to these two measures and their predecessors. OJD is neutral on the policy of question of whether or not grand jury proceedings should be recorded. We understand and appreciate the desire to record grand juries. That decision is a legislative one. If the legislature chooses to adopt this policy, OJD prefers that the role of the courts in relation to grand jury proceedings not be fundamentally changed to require that courts be responsible to record, store, and manage the recordings. If the legislature does give the courts any of these new responsibilities, they should be fully funded to allow this work to happen efficiently and effectively without disruption to the prompt resolution of all other matters before the court. My comments this morning really intend to focus on some of the processes employed to accomplish the recording of grand jury proceedings and managing the recordings once made of the 65 to 70,000 new felony filings every year. Under current law, the court's role with grand jury is very limited. We summons the grand jurors, typically part of the larger jury pool. Once selected and sworn, seven grand jurors go off with the district attorney, and we don't interact with them ever again until later when we process the payment for their jury service. Grand jury proceedings today occur outside the presence of the court, are managed again by the district attorney. Grand juries are convened in approximately 50 locations in 36 counties. While most locations are in courthouses, they are not in courtrooms or in parts of the building controlled by the court. They are in the offices of the district attorney or the county, and sometimes in off-site locations like child advocacy centers where there are no court staff. Both these Senate bills create a new role for courts that require development of new court program with a significant investment in staff and equipment. The major distinction between the two bills is that in Senate Bill 496, court staff is inserted into the grand jury proceedings to operate the recording equipment. If court staff is to do the recording, we would have to arrange access arrangements with district attorneys, coordinate our calendars for grand jury proceedings to ensure court staff can be present every time, every place a grand jury meets in every county. Senate Bill 505 gives responsibility to record grand jury proceedings to the district attorney in each county. However, once the proceedings are recorded, the recordings are turned over to the court, and later, if the DA wants a copy, they ask the court for it. No matter who does the recording, there must be trained staff who do that work. Just like you use professional staff to record your proceedings, you don't ask a member of the gallery to do it, and you don't ask a member to do it. And that's done to assure accuracy through monitoring the recordings and maintenance of log notes that allow us to efficiently and effectively find the locations in the recordings that are subject to protective order proceedings and to make copies as permitted. The court's role in managing the recordings, providing copies, redacting information will be made more difficult if there's inconsistent practices. With all that being said, what I really wanted to suggest to you this morning is that there is a simpler, more efficient, more cost-effective, straight-line approach to accomplish this policy goal put forward in this legislation. The preference of the OJD is that if grand jury proceedings are to be recorded, it'd be an obligation of the district attorney. They're already in the room. They can conduct and monitor the recording process. They can maintain the recordings for later distribution as permitted by the bill and would have immediate access for purposes of preparing motions for protective orders. This is consistent with a statute you heard talk about the other day when the grand juries already record minutes, handwritten minutes and notes, and district attorneys have retention schedules for keeping those minutes and making them available if and when they're ever asked for. And it's very rare today that they're asked for, but when they do get asked for, the court requires them to be released. The district attorney releases them. This procedure is also analogous to the discovery process in criminal cases. Courts today don't manage the day-to-day operation of discovery. We become involved only when a party doesn't comply with their obligation. We don't become the repository of all things that might later become the subject of a discovery request. For example, today we don't have and hold police reports and don't become part of our file. We'd be maintaining a separate file of all these grand jury proceedings outside of our case management system in its own separate segregated server. And that same model, discovery model, can be applied here. Courts would be involved only when there's a dispute about providing a copy of the recording to a party, make decisions concerning motions for protective orders, and whether or not to make a recording available to someone other than a party upon request. The parties have an obligation to follow the law, and when they don't, the courts can enforce that requirement. I look forward to continuing working with you and others in the proponents in this bill and development and implementation of this important criminal justice measure. And I'll wait till others are done to entertain any questions. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who's going to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of SpeakRight, which is a transcription company based in Austin, Texas. SpeakRight does a lot of work for the state of Oregon. We have agency-wide contracts with Department of Human Services, Oregon State Police, Oregon Department of Corrections. And so I just want to speak to the component of this bill, which is the transcription piece after a recording would be done. To let you know that transcription companies like SpeakRight can do that work quickly, very accurately, and at not high expense. No matter how the recording is done, whether it's a sophisticated recording system or two microphones plugged into a laptop, the file that's completed from that recording is, for SpeakRight, uploaded to their system. It is then routed out to transcriptionists, all of whom are based in the United States, all of whom have gone through background checks, are HIPAA compliant. The company does a lot of work with law enforcement, so they're very concerned about security. That recording is then typed, proofread, and then emailed back to whoever has the account in a password-protected file. Transcripts for, if it's just a short recording, are completed and returned within 3 hours. Their standard is at least three times the length of the recording. So if you have a grand jury proceeding that goes on for 2 or 3 hours, in the morning, you could upload that file. In the afternoon, it would be typed overnight, and it would be in your inbox when you arrive the next morning. So, and the price on this type of recording is 2 cents per word. So it depends on, what the formatting is you want on a document in terms of, spacing and margins. None of that matters. If there's multiple speakers, it's 2 cents a word, and it can be simple, quick, not very expensive.
Thank you. Patrick? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Warren Counties. At this time, AOC does not have a position on the policy of grand jury recordation. We support your efforts and the collective efforts of all the parties involved to come to a collaborative agreement, and look forward to coming back to supporting those efforts to increase accountability and transparency in our public safety system. We do have concerns with Senate Bill 505 requiring district attorney's offices to perform that function as a matter of cost to the counties. As you know, and we'll be expressing our concerns through the Ways and Means process as well, that DA's offices are mostly funded through county general fund. The state does provide some funding for DA's offices, and our counties, many rural counties, are strapped and operating at bare minimum public safety services for their constituents, and we would ask that should any effort move forward in terms of grand jury recordation, that the state provide full funding to provide professional equipment and staffing for that effort. Thank you very much.
Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our last panel that I have scheduled is Amanda Dalton and Kimberly McCullough. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else that came in thinking that this was going to be open for other individuals for a public hearing on either Senate Bill 496 or Senate Bill 505?
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the...
So the one thing I want to make certain, I have one other bill to be heard, and so I'm going to need to limit you all to about 8 minutes between the two of you.
No problem. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. You've already heard quite a bit about why recording the grand jury process is so important, and so I will save my comments on that. You can look at my testimony that I submitted, but I just want to address, excuse me, two issues. The first is regarding some testimony you heard earlier and that I've heard in previous discussions about this, about concerns about crime victims. And before I start, I just want to emphasize that we at the ACLU and myself personally do have deep concern about crime victims and about making sure that they're safe and that they have adequate rights. But what I heard is that there's a concern about the defendant finding out what the accusations of the crime victim are against that defendant. And this is in the case where there is a true bill. And so in the process that we're going through here, when there is a true bill, there is going to be a trial, unless there's a settlement. But if there is a trial, that trial is going to happen in open court, and the victim's testimony is going to be known not only by the defendant, but by the rest of the world or whoever is looking. What I heard is that the concern is that there may be some retribution or danger to the victim by the defendant hearing the victim's testimony. But what I'd like to suggest is what we're actually talking about is just a time period here. Is does the victim find out, excuse me, does the defendant find out after the grand jury proceeding, or does the defendant find out at the trial? And if there is really some danger or some concern about the victim's safety during that time period, I'd like to suggest that there are things that the court can do to protect that victim, and if there really is a risk that exists. But I'd just like to remind us all that, you know, defendants do have a right to a fair trial, to a fair system. We do have a right to open courts and to due process. And so I'd just like to suggest that this being disclosed to the defense attorney is part of that fairness and that open process. And I don't think that it poses any additional risk to a victim that is not already existing because of the fact that we have open trials. The second point that I'd like to address has to do with the public disclosure in the case of a not true bill when it relates to a public official. What I heard about that is that it's basically setting up a two-tiered system. The truth of the matter is that we often have different standards that apply to things that relate to public officials as it relates to their performance of their public duties. And the reason that we have a different standard is because we expect transparency in government. Public officials have power. They wield power in the system. As it relates to police officers, they have guns. They have the ability to use deadly force, right? So it makes sense that as it relates to the performance of their public duties, that there be some sort of transparency. It's very different than, say, for example, a public official in their private life or just some prominent person in society. The truth of the matter is that there are a lot of folks in the public that have distrust of the system, and secrecy reinforces that distrust. I'd just like to point out that there is a provision in the bill that allows the judge to not disclose it if it's, so they have to determine if it's in the public interest. So if there truly is a privacy interest at stake that is, that outweighs the public interest, the judge is going to be able to weigh that and make that determination. And also, I'd just like to point out very quickly that we have seen this play out in other states. If you just think about the Eric Garner's tragic death, and the trial there, the grand jury proceeding there, and the proceedings were not released to the public. There was a public outcry, and really, we can expect that same thing to happen here in Oregon if there is some sort of high-profile shooting or something like that, and it's not released. I think that you're going to hear from the public that they're like, what happened in that secret proceeding? And they don't trust it. And then without any transparency, they're going to fill in. It's like this human characteristic we have. We're going to fill in worst case scenario and assume that there's something wrong with the system. But actually having transparency there allows for the public to be able to see if justice was served. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Amanda?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. We represent about 60 Oregon-based public safety labor organizations, specifically our line police officers, here specifically to speak to the provision to release not true bill grand jury proceedings as it relates to either public servant or police officer. The grand jury, as you know and have heard much about in the last 2 days and 3 years, in returning a no true bill in the case of an officer involved incident, has either found that the prosecution could not provide the necessary evidence and that the officer acted in self-defense in the case of an officer involved shooting. The prosecutor has failed to make the showing that we demand before the state can subject a person to the control of the criminal justice system. Under the bill as proposed, we would remove this fundamental check on prosecutorial discretion, but only for police officers as presented in the dash one. Even when an officer's peers from across the community have found no evidence of wrongdoing, this bill would put an officer on public trial. Our Constitution guarantees everybody the right to a trial by a jury of their peers, but this bill would single out public officials or police officers only for a second public trial after a grand jury has spoken. We do not and would not do this to any other accused. Another concern for the grand jury proceedings depend on a degree of frankness that is not always relevant or prevalent in a courtroom. We cannot ignore the reality that witnesses who step up to testify on either side of an officer-involved incident potentially risk far more than the loss of simply a couple hours before a grand jury. They risk the exposure, the public scrutiny, and even statewide potential media scrutiny of their personal information, statements, considerations, and even past actions completely unrelated to the case before them. This bill would inevitably cause a chilling effect on the willingness of witnesses on all sides to come forward in investigations of wrongdoing. We are also concerned that the release of a grand jury recording or transcript would expose an officer to civil liability, at the very least release early evidence that the plaintiffs would potentially not see otherwise. The fact that a grand jury of the officer's peers has already found that the evidence was insufficient to indict and without representation of counsel before that grand jury would potentially expose that officer to unnecessary liability. We're currently in the process of completing research to fill in the blanks of what the DA's presented yesterday in terms of existing statute as it relates to this issue. So far, we've made it halfway through. We can't find a single state statute that permits release of a public officer's not true bill grand jury recording. It is discretionary. It has been done. You've heard from Multnomah County. They have an agreement right now to release a transcript. However, we can't find it in statute anywhere. So while Oregon never hesitates to be the first, you would likely be the first here. So we ask that you enter that with caution. To Senator Dembrough's question earlier, I'll be honest, our officers really struggled with this issue. We appreciate sometimes more public disclosure is better, and it does protect our officers. And to that point, if you do move forward with some kind of public servant or public police officer exception, we ask that you do the following five things, that you maintain it to apply to all public servants and you don't just single out police officers, that you limit the release to a transcript, not an audio or visual recording as currently presented in the bill. Officers respond differently to moments of traumatic experience, and lack of or over emotion, I think, in the public could be perceived the wrong way and taken out of context. We ask that you maintain the discretion, the balancing test that's currently present. You allow the court to continue to allow and set reasonable conditions on the release of it. That you potentially consider redacting witness identifying information in that public release of the transcript, and that you consider limiting the use of the transcript as it relates to the civil liability for the officer. Thank you.
Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Manning.
Thank you, Chair. Those are some very good points that you just highlighted. I would like to, for the record, say that, you know, I think there's going to be amendments and stuff that's coming further on this bill for more clarification, that there are definitely parts of those considerations as far as in terms of clarifying how we proceed with this. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Kimberly, thank you. What you're saying, that does a defendant find out what happened to the, what the defendant or what the victim is saying at the grand jury or at the trial, that they're going to find out? And I understand that, but the victim isn't necessarily represented, and when they're sitting there and they might be divulging, and there's other information coming in, I understand, like health records, possibly financial records or school records that really may or may not come up at trial and or be part of it. And it seems like those types of things you would want, you'd be all over wanting to keep private. And that's what I think, that's part of what I'm hearing from previous testimony, that there are things that just shouldn't be in the hands of the alleged perpetrator.
As Senator Thatcher, Chair Przonski, I think not being a criminal defense attorney, so I'm having a little bit of difficulty with understanding the sort of fine distinctions there. So I'm not sure that I can answer your question, but I'm thinking that Gail can probably follow up and talk to you about it. And Senator Przonski may even have an answer.
Your lifeline's walking up here, so Gail, come on up. One of the things is there's requirements for redaction of stuff that goes to the defense attorney. The defense attorney has an obligation to take certain things out. Mm-hmm. I believe the HIPAA is also an area that is somewhat covered. It depends on how it comes in. We just had some of that researched. And then financials and financial identifying information, that type of stuff, there's requirements for redaction.
Okay, thank you. I sounded like in previous testimony that could possibly be exposed.
I understand.
Chair Przonski and Vice Chair Thatcher, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this. The point's well taken. In an embezzlement case, the business records and the banking records are relevant to the charge. In an injury case, the medical records are relevant to the charge, and we already get that stuff through the course of discovery in any event. The discussion has been had that sometimes in the grand jury, a district attorney may take testimony, go down a rabbit hole, and then realize, I don't think I want to have any charges on that. And so that is an instance when the bill foresees that the district attorney could ask for the protective order as to this marker to that marker when we were pursuing that line of questioning. Your Honor, please, don't allow that to be disclosed. So that's one of the ways in which the protective order would be utilized. I might say, too, with respect to the protective order. No, you don't want to do that.
No. You answered the question. I have another bill I want to hear today. So unless there's a follow-up question at this point.
Thank you. My name is, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearings on Senate Bill 496 as well as Senate Bill 505. I appreciate those who came back today from yesterday's testimony. I apologize if we weren't able to get everyone in yesterday, but I'm pleased that you were able to make it back today. We're now going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 16. Whitney.
Thank you, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 16 was brought to us by the Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 16 provides protections for persons involved in DOC-facilitated dialogue or responsibility letter bank programs. It prohibits facilitators, advisory committee members, and staff persons involved in these programs from being compelled to testify or produce evidence in a judicial or administrative proceeding except by DOC rule. It also exempts these persons from civil liability except in certain circumstances, and it provides that these communications in these programs are confidential and inadmissible in other proceedings except by DOC rule. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. So we have Heidi Stewart, Mike Niemeyer, and then also Amy Davison. If you three would please come up, that'd be great. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who hasn't signed up yet for Senate Bill 16?
Good morning.
Right. Sorry to keep you long, but I'm also going to ask you to be short.
Absolutely. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 16. You have my testimony in front of you, I believe, electronically, so I'll keep this extremely brief because I really want to give the time to these two individuals next to me who can speak so much better about the importance of Senate Bill 16 to crime victims. So restorative justice programs, including facilitated dialogues and letter exchanges, can promote justice and healing for crime victims and survivors and aid inmates in the process of their rehabilitation. These dialogues and letters are most successful when the participants are able to communicate openly and honestly about the crime and impacts and its impacts, knowing that what they communicate will not be shared with other people or used against them later. It creates a space for victims and inmates to have an authentic conversation about what happened. So the department supports Senate Bill 16, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Mike?
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the ADR coordinator for the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm also a member of the advisory committee for the Facilitated Dialogue Program, and it's in that capacity as an advisory committee member that I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 16. The ability of crime victims and survivors to assert their autonomy and make meaningful choices regarding their recovery is essential. To be a victim of crime is to have control taken away from you, to have someone else impose their will over you. To the greatest extent possible, the victim or survivor should be able to exercise options that work for them as they guide their own recovery and response to a violent crime. For some victims and survivors, that may include the ability to talk directly with or receive a letter from their offender. For the last 13 years, the Department of Corrections has made facilitated dialogues available to crime victims who are seeking an opportunity to meet with their offender. These dialogues are always victim-initiated, and the agenda and purpose of each facilitated conversation is determined by and unique to that survivor. Whatever the goal or agenda for that dialogue, it frequently involves the most painful, intimate, and personal feelings and themes that a person will discuss in their entire lives. The FDP is designed to offer crime victims and offenders a dialogue that is as authentic as possible. One important element to this authenticity is the assurance that the victim or offender's communications won't show up in the media or be used in a subsequent proceeding against their wishes. Senate Bill 16 provides necessary and essential confidentiality for these dialogues. This bill also provides for the confidentiality of letters of responsibility written by an inmate to his or her victim. As with the dialogue program, this is a victim-initiated and victim-centered process. A crime victim will only be made aware of or receive a letter if they inquire about it. The confidentiality of Senate Bill 16 is necessary to prevent harm to victims and survivors who might otherwise open up a newspaper to see a letter from their offender. Like the dialogue program, the letter bank can have significant benefits for victims who choose to receive a letter, and for the offender who thoughtfully articulates their own responsibility for the crime. The confidentiality available through Senate Bill 16 is not unlimited. The bill gives the Department of Corrections the ability through rulemaking to create exceptions to confidentiality to ensure program effectiveness and the safety of the participants. This bill is essential to the effectiveness of these programs, and I urge your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, and Amy.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Amy Davidson, and I am the Crime Survivor Program Director for Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide nonprofit organization that has worked in Oregon since 1999 to advance policy solutions to crime that ensure justice, equity, accountability, and healing to achieve safe and strong communities. I'm here today to ask for your support in Senate Bill 16. So I spent over a decade working with both crime survivors and the people who caused them harm in an intimate direct service setting. Overwhelmingly, survivors felt that their process of healing could only occur if they felt safe and if they heard the person who caused them harm take responsibility for what had occurred. So for many, this actually has a more lasting impact than even the feeling of a restored sense of safety that sometimes comes with the incarceration of the person who had harmed them. This bill has the potential for truly meaningful impact to an existing program that facilitates a process of accountability and healing. The Oregon Department of Corrections has set forth a proposal that offers inmates and survivors broader confidentiality when they elect to participate in the facilitated dialogue or utilize the Responsibility Letter Bank program. Practitioners of restorative process already know that honest transference of information and story creates the strongest safe space for healing to occur for both sides of the harm. It's nearly impossible to achieve that level of honesty without the promise of confidentiality. The experience of losing control over one's information relating to the intimate details of harm caused to them can essentially feel like re-victimization by the system for survivors. So for those who caused harm, the common feeling over time is the desire to express remorse directly to the person that they harmed. While the facilitated dialogue process offers no guarantees to either party, what it does provide is a means for a person who caused the harm to engage in their own continuum of accountability, healing, and change without the expectation of forgiveness. This is part and parcel in restorative process work. For the person who was harmed, this offers a way for them to finally receive the information they've needed and to get that on their terms, so that they can move forward. So under the provisions of Senate Bill 16, facilitated dialogues and the Responsibility Letter Bank program can really meet both those needs. Accountability stands to change behavior in ways that punishment cannot. Senate Bill 16 may be one answer to the question of whether we're really doing all that we can to meet the needs of those impacted by crime. So we would ask you to please support Senate Bill 16 and support real healing. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16.
Thank you.
Where are we at? Do you want to go ahead and look at the building? Open the work session on Senate Bill 16. Madam
Vice Chair. I will do this. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 16 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Any volunteers? Senator Denbrough will be our carrier. We'll close the work session. I want to thank everyone for being here. We're scheduled to be here next Monday at 8:30. We're adjourned. I just need to call it.
Just sneak up on Kevin and get some.
I'm in the middle of this meeting, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You mentioned that last.
Yeah, I just, Mr. Chair, just to remind you, I do have a nine, I think, close right. By, so I can stay for a little bit. So there are work sessions we need to do or something.
Yeah. You got a medical thing to do. We're going to start to pay for it. And so,
oh, that's right. Yeah, I wouldn't be here for more than a few minutes.
No, you'll be excused from this is pretty off for the following
Monday.
I can't
but I don't know what time.
For the following Monday.
I can't but I don't know what time.